My name is Michael Nassani, and I'm a member of the Aramac Committee as well. And I also teach anthropology at Western Michigan University. As an anthropologist, one of the things that we claim to study is the human condition at all times, at all places. And one of the things that I've learned by virtue of studying the history of our discipline is that anthropologists were very much complicit in creating the race concept. So in the 19th century, they essentially came up with groupings that were quite arbitrary, but nevertheless served a particular purpose, namely to create a hierarchy of different social groups, essentially based on skin color. And even though we study this, and sort of, many of us hold it at arm's length, maybe not so much recognizing that this legacy permeates to the present, and indeed it serves to dehumanize us all. So this is the power of racism, not only to oppress people of color, but also to privilege those of whiteness, as well as essentially, as I just mentioned, to dehumanize all of us, and in fact challenge one of our very central principles as you use. The other thing, though, that we learn from anthropology is that there were people in the past who were willing to speak out against racism. And we tried to showcase this almost a year ago when we talked about, for example, the Underground Railroad, and how in the 19th century there were people, abolitionists, people who worked across the color line to challenge the insidious institution of slavery. And despite the fact that that's been disbanded, again, the legacy of slavery lives on in so many different ways in the form of racial inequality. And so I think this recognition is an important first step, but we can't stop there. Indeed, we need to consider the ways that we can put into practice in our community, in our everyday lives, and so forth, new ways of thinking, new ways of being, and ways of interrupting these relationships that, again, are very much destructive of us as humans. It's important for people who have white privilege, I think, to recognize this and to speak out against it. And one of the people that I take inspiration from is Tim Wise. And he has been to Kalamazoo on a number of occasions, a very powerful anti-racist white male who speaks out very forcefully against racism and allows us to think about new ways to envision white privilege and again, its destructive tendencies. So I just wanted to share just a few words of his today. And he says, "Hardly any aspect of my life, from where I had lived, to my education, to my employment history, to my friendships, had been free from the taint of racial inequity, from racism, from whiteness. My racial identity had shaped me from the womb forward. I had not been in control of my own narrative. It wasn't just race that was a social construct, so was I." Well, in doing some of the anti-racism work in the church as well as in the community, I've had the opportunity to meet a very staunch anti-racist advocate, and I'd like to introduce her today. Erica Barajas was born and raised in a suburban town in Northern California. She has a bachelor's degree in evolution and ecology and a master's degree in science education. After working as a science teacher for several years, she served as a natural resources volunteer in the U.S. Peace Corps. She moved to Kalamazoo in 2009 for her husband Mark to pursue his PhD in counseling psychology at Western Michigan University. Erica is currently the executive director at Fair Food Matters, a nonprofit organization that works to improve access to healthy local food in Kalamazoo. She's also about to graduate from Western Michigan University with a Bachelor in Fine Arts in printmaking. In her time in Kalamazoo, she has also served on the board of directors at the People's Food Co-op, played percussion with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, and was trained as a facilitator of introductory workshops in analyzing systemic racism. The Aramac Committee invited Erica to join us today to share what she is learning from doing anti-racism work within the food system in Kalamazoo. She'll address the importance of reflecting on our own identity development as we engage in service to others. Let's explore together why it might be helpful to explicitly but not exclusively talk about race when we are engaging in social justice work.
Thank you, Michael. And hello. Good morning. Let me get my... I have a time limit, and I have plenty of things that I would love to say, so I'm going to hold myself accountable here. It's 11:20. So I'd like to start out by saying thank you to the Aramaic Committee for inviting me to speak today. I attended several of their committee meetings in advance of today to learn more about what's going on here and what parts of my story might be helpful to share with you. I'm also really grateful to the church and that committee in particular for sending Elisa Lati to the ERASE training, which then has had a ripple effect at Fair Food Matters and at the People's Food Co-op as far as building those institutions' ability to do anti-racism work. And then another thing I'd like to acknowledge is that I don't spend a lot of time speaking to large groups where we don't have dialogue. I have training as a high school teacher, and I love to hear where my students are coming from and really incorporate where they're at into what I'm doing. So this is a unique challenge for me today as far as it being a one-directional thing, and I look forward to talking with you in the foyer afterwards if you want to actually have a conversation. Another job that I had in my 20s was as a whitewater rafting guide, and I found that my experience with guiding in that context relates a lot to teaching and also relates a lot to doing social organizing work, that the primary goal is to keep everybody safe and make sure that they have a relatively good time. And so even if someone falls out of the boat, they survive and they're a little shaken up and they've learned something and can appreciate life in a different way. So I'm not saying that I'm going to, I hope that no one falls out of the boat permanently today. But my goal is for us to have a safe discussion here that may be a little uncomfortable. I'll just acknowledge that. So I'm curious how many people in this room have ever had a conversation about race and racism that did not go so well? Yeah. So when we have these conversations, it's often helpful to name some of the assumptions that we have going into the conversation. And when we're doing it in a group conversation, usually we kind of make a community agreement about how we're going to be together. So some assumptions that I'm coming with today is that we are all teachers and learners here. So there's a lot of lived experience in the room coming from all of us, and I'm only one of those people. I've learned a lot through this process, and I hope to learn from you today after the service as well. And another assumption I have, specifically talking about racism, is that the goal in doing anti-racism work is not to identify who the bad apples are and get them out. right? So it's not about blame and pointing fingers. It's really about looking, taking a step back and looking at the structure of our society and what we might be able to rework to be more effective towards our common vision of inclusion. And then also I found something, I was given some really helpful brochures by the committee to learn more about UUism. And one of the things that stuck out to me was that there's an acknowledgement that truth is complicated, that truth is multifaceted and elusive. Those are the words in the brochure that I thought was interesting. So thinking about what you're going to hear from me today, my lived experience, and how it may align or be in dissonance with what your lived experience has been, and that there's room for all of our experiences in this work, and that's what we're trying to create. So I will be speaking from my own experience, and I just ask that you listen deeply, both to what I'm saying, but also to what comes up in you as you're listening. So what are you thinking? What are you feeling as you hear what I've been through? So there are a few terms I want to clarify that I'll be using from time to time. One is the term prejudice, and the other one is the term racism. And I used to think that those terms were actually interchangeable, that it was kind of an individual thing. Someone could be prejudiced and racist, and they could be sexist and all these other ists. And from doing the work with ERASE specifically, which is the organization eliminating racism and claiming and celebrating equality, I've learned that there's a difference between prejudice and what typically is referred to as racism within the social work environment. I know, Weaver, you've heard this so many times. It's like, enough. So when I say prejudice, I'm talking about a subconscious thing that happens with all humans. When we see something, we think we know something about that thing. So whether it's a person or a situation, that there's this kind of primitive, intuitive response that happens when we walk into a situation. It's to our benefit to kind of make some quick decisions about what's going on there. And all people have prejudice as far as we can't know every possible thing about everything we're going into. So it's a kind of a shortcut for us to be able to function in the world. And prejudice in itself maybe isn't always bad. It's just something to be aware of and to learn more about as far as uncovering your own biases. And where racism is different, that it's a function of our society that actually takes one group's prejudice and turns it into, through institutions and systems, turns it into a hierarchy like Michael was talking about. So taking, for example, white people's values and saying, this is the universal way things should be, and working that into a system, starting with our Constitution and coming to present day. So those terms have a lot of meanings to a lot of different people. So I just wanted to kind of clarify what I mean when I say those two words. And then we also refer to people of color, and I find it helpful to recognize that that doesn't just mean black people. So we're talking about Latinos and Asian Americans and Arab Americans and Native Americans and all these other subcategories, including multiracial and biracial people. So I wanted to clarify that, and then also say that I'm going to consistently use the term white people, even though I used to identify as pink, just because I was, not socialized to think of myself as a white person. And I'm probably more pink up here because it's like I'm nervous. So I can actually feel it right now. But when I say white, I mean people of European descent. And then the only other term that sometimes can mean different things for different people is privilege, which in the context of whiteness and also kind of class privilege can be things from owning a house, being married, having access to education, and living in a world that's designed for right-handed, non-disabled people. So those are some key terms, and I can already tell that I'm behind schedule, so we're going to cut some things. So
Sorry, I'm being transparent about my process here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what my thoughts and feelings were before I started doing anti-racism work, what I found through doing that work so far, and where I'm at now. So those are kind of my three subcategories. So before moving to Kalamazoo, I didn't have a lot of experience, besides when I was a teacher, in working with people of color. And I really should say, I did get my first experience working with people of color as a teacher. So the school that I taught at was very diverse in downtown Sacramento. But I wasn't thinking about myself as a white person in that context, so I tend to not think of that as my first experience. So really, being in Kalamazoo has given me a lot of opportunities to reflect on myself as a white person doing work with people of color. And part of that work is to examine my own status as far as what privileges I have, and challenging my assumptions and biases. And one of the first people to really challenge me was actually my husband, who is a biracial Latino man, who, you know, started pointing things out to me. And it was a lot harder to hear coming from him. So I'm starting to hear him better now that I'm hearing it from other people. But he was part of my motivation to start learning more about how I act as a white person and what I bring to our relationship. And also just thinking about if and when we have kids, how am I going to contribute to that parenting, and not just being oblivious to what I bring into the relationship. And he's also being trained as a counseling psychologist, which has a counseling psychology as a field focuses on the systemic nature of us as social beings. So I really, when I was hired at Fair Food Matters, I was hired as a garden manager and working at a garden, both at Woodward Elementary School, which is right on the border of the Stewart and Northside neighborhoods, which is a part of town that is predominantly African American, and then at a garden that was further north. So I spent a lot of time in that neighborhood and just was able to observe the difference between that neighborhood and where I live in the Winchell neighborhood. So I got some exposure during that time and basically just started seeing that I needed to learn some things. And it was distressing to see, working within the food realm, to see that in my neighborhood I have access to two pretty large full-service grocery stores. And in the north side, at the time, they had the workings of the Park Street Market coming there, which is a full-service grocery store. But mostly there were convenience and liquor stores in that neighborhood. So just seeing some visible differences between one neighborhood and the other gave me some questions that I wanted to address. So when I met Elisa, and she was on our board of, she is still on the board of directors at Fair Food Matters. She and I had the opportunity to serve on the Fellowship to Advance Racial Equity, which was a year-long convening of people from the nonprofit realm who are doing youth development work that the Community Foundation put together. And so through that fellowship, I got to attend the ERASE analysis workshop, which sometimes is referred to as the 2.5 day, if you've heard that. And so from there, it was just kind of got the ball rolling as far as conversations. Having someone to talk about it with was really important, and we could talk strategically about Fair Food Matters and where Fair Food Matters was at, what we needed as an institution, and also talk about ourselves as individuals and what we're bringing to the work. So from going through that workshop and from doing this work with Elisa, I found that some of my instincts, which were to, when I saw these disparities in access to healthy food, my instinct was to go and like save the day and bring in a farmer's market to the Northside neighborhood. So I did that. And I now know that it's not always helpful to just try to come in and save the day. That there's a lot of steps in order to be accountable to a neighborhood, there's a lot of steps that need to happen to have the neighborhood actually identify what they need, rather than me coming in as an outsider and saying, I love farmers markets, you should have one. And actually, Sue's reading talked a little bit about doing things to people rather than with them. So I think looking back, there was that dynamic of kind of doing this to the neighborhood rather than with them. And that's not always helpful. Through working with ERACE and specifically going to their monthly regional caucusing, which you're allowed to go to after you've been through the analysis workshop, I'm learning that I've been socialized as a white person to behave in certain ways. So when I think about the tendencies that I have to want to find the one right way to do things and to have that be efficient and have an agenda with times on it, and even this whole thing of like keeping myself on time, I just thought that was something my parents taught me to do. And they did, but it was also reinforced over and over and over again by a greater society, and there are all these things that are that we're socialized to believe and ways that we're socialized to behave that are actually tied to our racial identity. So as I started working with people of color, I found that showing up at a meeting with an agenda with times on it didn't always work. And I was like, what's that about? And I found that my agenda and my need to stick to the time on the agenda was not always helpful, because part of what the work was to get to know the people that I was working with. And when the focus was on being efficient and getting through the agenda items, there was a lost opportunity to learn about what was going on in their lives and to share what's going on in my life. And so that was something that I continue to learn, is that I've been socialized to behave certain ways. So, yes, I'm on time now. Ah, it feels good. Okay. So, yeah, and there's like even that just reinforces that I'm, it's good to be efficient. So, in doing this work, I can tell that I've changed, and there's some things that I feel now, and some things that I'm coming to understand now that weren't present for me before. One of the main things is that I know that I have more to learn and that I don't have it all figured out and that I need other people to be able to work it out together. And it's not just about race. It's about gender and sexual identity and physical ability and religion and all these other social identities. And ERACE does talk about that in terms of intersectionality theory, and that it's helpful to talk explicitly about race because sometimes it's just left out because it's uncomfortable. But it's also helpful to not be exclusive, to only talk about race and neglect to talk about the other social identities where there is that hierarchy as well. And what's interesting, though, is that if you leave out the racial piece when talking about something like feminism, you're coding the conversation for whiteness. So Michael Pollan, who's a food author and journalist, was just here in town, and he was talking about feminism during the 60s being about women getting out of the house and going to work. And when I hear that now, I realize that really what he's talking about is white women getting out of the house and going to work, and that women of color were actually already working several jobs to support their families. So if we start the conversation with only part of the truth, it codes that conversation and makes it exclusive. So we're just talking about white people here. That's just something I noticed recently, which is interesting. It's an opportunity for someone like Michael Pollan, who can fill a room with 2,500 people who are mostly white that night, that it's a missed opportunity for him to clarify that he's really talking about white women when he says that, and that race can be a dividing factor in any of these other social classes. So thinking about how it's different for a black man to come out as gay versus a white man to come out as gay, those kinds of things. Critics of this kind of topic might consider learning about whiteness as a form of navel gazing, that it's a waste of time to talk about us, that we should be talking about the oppression that's happening, we need to fix that. But I find it interesting, the phrase navel gazing, if you think about like breaking that down, your navel and what your navel is, your belly button being this artifact of coming into the world and being like where you come from in some ways, that it's actually really useful to reflect on where you've come from. And so what's so bad about that, you know? So I've been really embracing that, trying to learn as much as I can. You know, I'm privileged in that I know a certain amount of my family history because it's been preserved and there's documents and things like that. So you know, as much as we can learn about our past and where we come from, it's really valuable. I'm also becoming more and more comfortable with messiness. I was definitely socialized at growing up to, you know, we're all, you know, socialized to clean our room, right? But it was pretty, you know, I remember my dad being like, after I started doing my own laundry, I would straighten out all my shirts and lay them out on the bed or the floor. And he'd be like, no, put them in the closet, just put them away right away. It's the one touch method. So there was this bias towards, you know, cleanliness and order and whatever. And so I'm getting more and more comfortable with things getting messy and uncomfortable from doing this work and realizing that kind of like falling out of the boat in the river, sometimes the messy parts can be more life-giving. You're going to remember a boat trip more when you've fallen out and gotten back into the boat than a boat trip where you just stayed in the boat the whole time. I'm also becoming more and more uncomfortable with unpredictable situations. And the biggest thing that's happened to me in the last 2 years that has given me the opportunity to practice being comfortable with that is that I'm a cancer survivor. So I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma last January, went through chemotherapy, I'm healthy now. There's a whole lot when you're faced with any kind of health or illness situation where you don't know what's going to happen, the doctors don't know what's going to happen, and I hadn't had much experience with that before. So that really gave me, I'm not saying go get cancer to learn how to cope with messiness. Don't do it. But it's something we can't control, right? So there's a socialization that happens to us as white people that makes us want to control our situation and know what's going to happen next. And if we don't know what's going to happen next, we get really uncomfortable. So I'm getting more comfortable being uncomfortable, if that makes any sense. Nope. I'll tell you that part in the foyer if you want to know the next part. So as I'm wrapping up, you can tell it's very. I hope you can tell that this has been incredibly life-giving work to learn more about racial identity and to be able to have some tools for thinking about it that I didn't have before. And it's such a privilege to be able to come and share what I've learned with you today. And I really feel, I haven't talked much about the spiritual part behind all this work, that there's a lot of spiritual or religious words that sometimes can be problematic. But I do feel like there is a higher power guiding me to be able to do some of this work. The people I've met and the messages that I've heard, I do feel are part of a bigger vision for the world. And it's mysterious and amazing, and it blows my mind all the time. So I do feel that being willing to lean into this discomfort is a skill, and that it's a form of unconditional love to approach the world and be able to see the ugly parts and love those parts too, and not necessarily accept them, but not run away from them and face them. So I appreciate having the opportunity to share my experience with you today. I wanted to just highlight some things that are available through the congregation here in case you're interested in learning more. There are analysis workshops, the 2.5-day workshop that I referred to through ERACE. There's one coming up December 4th through 6th, And there actually are funds available through the Aramaic Committee to send you to that training. So it's really just a matter of if you can make the time to go. And they do happen 3 or 4 times a year. And once you go to that workshop, then you have access to this regional caucusing tool, which is a place to extend the conversation in an environment where everyone has been through the training. So it's a really helpful tool. And then early next year, there's going to be the church is actually bringing in someone to talk about beyond categorical thinking, which is in preparation for you to select a new pastor. So thinking about these categories of race and gender and class and all these things and how the categories themselves can be problematic, but really getting beyond using those categories as a tool, but getting beyond just simplifying people down to their labels. And there's also going to be an introductory level workshop, hopefully, as long as the grant that's been applied for goes through, which is what we call the appetizer version of the analysis workshop. It's a 1-day workshop that may be happening soon. And you can also join the Aramaic Committee, right? Yeah, okay. So in closing, I'd like to read a poem that is used to open each month's regional caucusing that's facilitated by ERACE. I wanted to make sure to cite the author, so I did some research and actually found out that there's more to the poem than what we read at caucus. Did you know that? Yeah. I also learned that, because I was trying to find the name of the author actually wished to remain anonymous. So that's why it's not cited. So thank you again for listening to me today. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. If you'd like to discuss anything in the foyer after the service, or feel free to contact me later to discuss your thoughts over a cup of tea or a bowl of soup, since it's cold. And I did bring Fairfood Matters brochures for you, and they'll be out there. If you want to learn more about Fairfood Matters, since I didn't talk too much about that, and my contact information is on there, so feel free to contact me. So with that, this is Listen. When I ask you to listen to me and you start giving me advice, you have not done what I asked. When I ask you to listen to me and you begin to tell me why I shouldn't feel that way, you're trampling on my feelings. When I ask you to listen to me and you feel that you have to do something to solve my problems, you have failed me, strange as that may seem. Listen. All I ask is that you listen, not talk nor do, just hear me. And I can do for myself. I'm not helpless, maybe discouraged and faltering, but not helpless. When you do something for me that I can and need to do for myself, you contribute to my fear and weakness. But when you accept as a simple fact that I do feel what I feel, no matter how irrational, then I quit trying to convince you and can get about the business of understanding what's behind this irrational feeling. When that's clear, the answers are obvious, and I don't need advice. Irrational feelings make sense when we understand what's behind them. Perhaps that's why prayer works sometimes for some people, because God is mute and doesn't give advice to try to fix things. God just listens and lets you work it out for yourself. So please listen and just hear me. And if you want to talk, wait a minute for your turn and I'll listen to you. Thank you.